This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Pete Zimmerman's the producer. Hi again, it's John Williams. Our first guest is Tom Gimbel, the founder and CEO at LaSalle Network. Tom, thanks for joining us again. You're on WGN.
Always good to be with you, John Williams.
I know that you and Pete were having a conversation about an index I'm not that familiar with, the ISM Activity Index, but the news behind this sounds pretty good. Can you catch me up on this?
Well, I think there's a lot that's going on as you and I talk about all the time of employees coming back to work, the Stress Awareness Month being in April, and how to handle conflict resolution. And those are really the issues that I think are paramount right now that are worth really discussing.
Okay, so talk to me about Stress Awareness Month. We just got through Stress Awareness Year, so April is the month. Maybe that's tax month. I wonder why they picked that one, and what should we know about it?
Well, the other 11 were probably booked. So, we're looking at, from an employee perspective, is we've got to get past this giving everybody a free pass because of COVID. And what I mean by that, not being a tough guy, however, we've got to look at individual cases now of what's bothering people. Everybody handles things differently. Some people have gotten the vaccine, how they're approaching it. But as a manager of people, we've got to really understand what makes our people tick, where the stress factor is, how much of it is work versus their personal life versus extracurricular activities, and be able to manage accordingly. The day of IBM, where everybody's in a white shirt, blue suit, and managed the exact same way, those days are gone. In an employee-driven market like we have now, if we're not in touch with our employees and their stress levels, and where we can push people into the red zone on the RPM and where we have to let our foot off the gas, we're really going to lose some good people.
Tom, that's the most sympathetic thing I've ever heard you say. I'm glad to hear you talk that way.
You're getting to me, John.
Oh, I don't think I am. But I suppose, though, one takeaway is right. Pandemic, everybody broad brush was painted with that. But some people react differently. Are you also saying some people need a little more nurturing or leeway when we come back?
Well, I believe both. I believe that some people need a little more nurturing. Others need a bigger kick in the butt. And I know that's the part of me that you like, John. The fact of the matter is when people are stressed, there's good stress and there's bad stress. And sometimes it's not that they're stressed because they have too much work. It's that they're stressed and that they don't have a plan for how to attack it. And those are confused all the time. You've got to make sure that people have a clear plan on how to do their job. I always give the analogy to a quarterback is that so many managers want their people to be quarterbacks who call their own plays. But at the end of the day, some have that skill, and some are just great quarterbacks that need the offensive coordinator to call the plays for them. Either one is very valuable. You just have to make sure that you give the people the play who need it and give the autonomy to the ones who don't and let them go.
And are these issues more acute right now? Because I'll assume that businesses are starting to go back into the offices. So they're leaving the comfort of their home. Maybe there's new interactions in the office they hadn't had in a year. Who knows what we're going to see in the hallways, right?
Yeah, well, I think it's a really interesting time because, from a study perspective, John, because if you notice, Google released a statement that they're going to start bringing some people back, and they were one of the first ones last year to say, we're not bringing anyone back until 2022. And all of a sudden, when you see the vaccines are going to be fully distributed by the end of May, it looks like. And if things with the warm weather and everybody's starting to get on airplanes again, that now companies are giving this a second thought. And so you have employees who are thinking, hey, wait a second, we're going to be working from home for a long time to now, I don't know. And it's really the employer's responsibility to give clear communication so people can start to process. Reentry is going to be a heck of a lot harder than leaving the workplace was a year ago. And we've got to manage people accordingly. We've got to have some empathy for what they're going through emotionally.
I just want to read this paragraph here, a sentence. On Monday, data from the IHS Market and the Institute for Supply Management on Activity in the Services Sector blew the doors off analysts' expectations as the ISM's activity index surged to a record high. IHS Markit's reading was the best in 7 years, an all-time high of 63.7%. This is the service sector, and they are expecting that there is going to be a tremendous new amount of spending on services, I guess, starting this summer. I don't suppose you're surprised to hear that.
No, I think what we're going to have is really twofold, is that business is coming out of the gates hot. We saw that jobs report last week of almost 1 million new jobs added. That's an astronomical number. With that, and having employees return to work, if they're crazy stressed, or return to the office, they've been working for the past year, return to the office, and the stress with that, and or if they leave their job because they don't want to return to the office and have to take a new job, it creates more stress. So we're going to have this dual path going simultaneously. And one is the economy booming. Number two, the stress level for employees at a higher than ever pace. And it's just a very interesting dynamic. And I think the winners from corporate America will be the ones that reach out and have very pro-employee friendly programs without letting the inmates run the asylum.
It's an interesting point. April is Stress Awareness Month, so how managers can tell if employees are stressed and what to do about it, from Tom Gimbel, founder and CEO of LaSalle Network. The website is thelasallenetwork.com. Thanks, Tom. We'll talk again soon.
Never stressed being with you.
Interesting report out from Bankrate. And it's about your insurance on your car, what it's costing you, what it should cost you, and what happens if things go badly. Here is Stephen Cates, the CFP and insurance analyst for Bankrate.com. Hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, John. Glad to be here.
The report just came out. What's the headline? What's the most important thing you all noticed?
So I think one of the big things that we noticed is that, you know, when it comes to car insurance, different cities around the country and certainly different states around the country have vastly different insurance rates. And I think anybody who is interested to understand how they stack up, they should check out this report and understand different ways to improve that cost.
I suppose some of it is inevitable. If you live in Chicago versus a rural area, there's no getting around that. The cost is going to be higher, right?
I think that's certainly a big impact. You know, cities are going to be more costly than more rural areas. Certainly places in the north where you get a lot of harsh weather could be more costly than places down south where it's a little bit more mild. So those things happen. But one of the things that we did find is that certain activities that you do also have vastly different results in different areas.
I want to talk about those, although let's just mention this too. Your report says that the average Chicago Metro driver spends on auto insurance about $1,662, and that's the national average, which is kind of surprising to me. I guess Washington, D.C., San Francisco, Manhattan drive it up, and Kansas drives it down. So we're right in the middle, $1,660 or $1,670, right?
Yep, that's correct. Yeah, $1,662 is actually $12 less than the national average. And what we found is that, you know, a lot of areas, and a better comparison maybe to Chicago than a San Francisco or an L.A. might be to Boston, which is actually one of the lowest costs. You know, they have similar, you know, sort of northern weather patterns in some cases, certainly a city, but costs are significantly less.
Why? Why is
under that 2% line that we like to look for?
Why is Boston less? You would think that would be just as high or worse than Chicago.
So this is where some of the activities that drivers get into can really impact how their auto insurance is calculated. And some of this does come down to state regulations that govern some of these things. But what we found that, you know, in Chicago versus somewhere like Boston, you know, you're seeing much higher costs on things like, you know, credit score decreases. When you go from a good credit score to a lower credit score, you know, those costs are significantly higher in a Chicago area than they are in Boston.
Wonder why that is. Is that a legislative thing?
So I think it's some of the ways that insurance companies look at how they judge risk. And, you know, they're taking into account credit scores much more than other cities around the country, other states around the country. Huh. Now, in some cases, Chicago is better off where you know they see less of an increase in cost for other things like getting into an accident or getting a ticket. And so, you know, it does even out in some cases.
You mentioned 2% just a moment ago. What's that? 2% of my income should go to insurance, or what's the calculation?
So what we typically look at is that anything greater than 2%, and Chicago's coming in at 2.3%, anything greater than 2% is borderline unaffordable. And this is from a national perspective. That's what the Federal Reserve has stated. Their belief from a cost perspective when it comes to personal finance is that you should keep your costs under 2%.
That, again, to be clear, 2% of your annual household income.
Annual income.
Annual household income. Your auto insurance or homeowners as well, just car insurance?
Just car insurance.
Wow, that strikes me as a pretty high percent. I guess, yeah, you certainly want to be south of 2%. And then you also scored what happens if you get a DUI, a crash. Can you walk us through that a little bit?
Absolutely. So DUI is certainly a very serious situation here. And what we found is that, you know, an additional $1,400 roughly is what you would see an increase to your auto insurance by just getting a conviction of a DUI. So that would take your car insurance from that $1,662 we quoted to somewhere north of $3,000.
Got it. That's a DUI. I guess I'm not surprised to hear that my insurance would almost double. Mm-hmm. What else mitigates my insurance cost?
So one of the things that can certainly improve your insurance costs is, you know, is doing really the activities around like comparing, contrasting your insurance company's costs, you know, speaking to them about what you can do to reduce that cost, whether it's bundling insurance, whether it's raising deductibles, but exploring all those opportunities with your own insurance company and other competing insurance companies can really get you the best rate.
I did want to refer to a chart that you have here, and it says, okay, mm-hmm. So say on average, and in your Chicago, you're about average, about $1,660 a year for auto insurance. Is that per vehicle or per household? Because a lot of folks have two cars or three cars.
So what we looked at in the study is that we looked at 40-year-old men and women with one car with a good credit score owning a Toyota Corolla.
Which is
pretty average right, mid-tier right. car. And so we were looking at a single car. And that's something that if you have more cars, more drivers, you could see a much higher rate.
Or if you're driving a Mercedes versus a Toyota or a Chevy as well, right?
Exactly, yeah. Cost for repairs, you know, sourcing parts, generally, you know, a variety of factors with those cars is going to impact the way that they're insured. One of the things I was going to mention when it comes to how you look at insurance is the amount of drivers you have. Specifically young drivers, what we found, and this is nationally, is that adding a teen driver to your insurance is the most costly thing that you can do. It typically adds close to $2,000 in Chicago, and in some cases, even more than that nationally.
What are you going to do? If you got a teen and they're driving, you got to insure them, right?
You got to insure them, absolutely. And so that's just something that people should prepare for. They should understand what those costs could certainly be and any ways to mitigate that, like comparing insurance, shopping around, raising deductibles if you can afford it.
Or just not having teenagers. Also, it says here, here's your chart. If it's $1,660 for the average insurance, but if you let your insurance coverage lapse and now you've got to go back, they're going to charge you a nick for that. You go to $1,860 versus $1,660. If you get a speeding ticket, you're over $2,000. If you get in a car crash, you're closer to $2,500. If you get a DUI, you're closer to $3,300 versus $1,660, according to a recent report at Bankrate.com. Okay, very helpful information. I think folks should go back and look at this. Bankrate.com. Stephen Cates, insurance analyst. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, John. Have a great day.
And this is a conversation that is important to a lot of us, and some of us most particularly, because April is Autism Awareness Month. My nephew is autistic, and my godson lives with autism as well. Two more different young men you would not meet. Different personalities, different skill sets, and yet it seems to fall under the same umbrella. So let's get a little expert advice, not only about that, but how these people might be able to work. David Friedman is the founder and CEO of Autonomy Works. I'll give you the website in just a second. You might want to write it down. David, you're on WGN Radio. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
What is autism?
Autism is a communication disorder that causes challenges for people in how they interact, how they read interpersonal cues, and how they communicate with others. Autism is a spectrum, though, so it expresses itself in different ways in different people. There are some people with autism that have challenges with day-to-day living skills, and then there are some people with autism that you might never know that they were autistic or that it had any part in their life.
That's interesting. And it can be high IQ, low IQ. I mean, even that's not a determining factor, right?
No. Actually, autism has very little to do with intellectual ability. There are some people with autism with quite high IQs, and some on the other end of the bell curve. But it's really characterized much more by the challenges in communications and focuses on particular topics and activities.
How is it that you came to found this organization?
Yeah, I have a son. His name's Matt. He's 25 years old now, and he has autism. And like a lot of people with autism, he's really, really good at lots of things, really good with puzzles, really good with numbers, really good with patterns. And, when he was in high school, we started looking at what he was going to do after high school and realized that he probably wasn't going to go to a traditional college, just doesn't have the social skills or the executive functioning to succeed there. So what my wife and I started doing was looking and seeing what he could do afterwards, figured there had to be a job for him somewhere. And what we found was really shocking. The unemployment rate of adults with autism is around 80%, higher than any other disability. And many of the people with autism that are working are in low-skill jobs. They're cleaning tables or stocking shelves. They're not doing anything that taps into the skills and talents that so many people with autism have.
So what do you do about that?
Well, I founded Autonomy Works. Autonomy Works is the easiest way to think about it is as a business process outsourcing company. We outsource operations work, finance operations for manufacturing, supply chain, finance companies. And we've hired a team of people with autism to do the work. We've tapped into the skill. I mentioned earlier that it's a spectrum, so it's a wide range of talents. But there's a significant subset of people with autism that have really, really strong skills at detail, attention to quality, process discipline that make them exceptional at the kind of work that has to get outsourced and has to get done correctly every single time for lots of big companies.
Yeah, in fact, that's, I think, how it demonstrates itself to some people sometimes, is that's almost hyper-attention to detail, which might seem odd, but also, if that's how they're functioning or processing, might make them very valuable employees, too, huh?
It does. It's if you can focus that attention and that intensity against business processes, they do a great job with it. And the other thing which I think is really interesting about a lot of people with autism, because of this focus, so many people you hire out of college these days, they want variety in their job. They want to do something for a few months and then try something else. People with autism like to get great at things. They like to focus on a particular set of tasks and do them over and over again so they can get mastery at them. And this is great for any kind of process where you want someone to really learn it, to be excellent at it, and to be able to do it for years and years and months over time.
I presume no one's going to characterize this interest as taking advantage of their disability, that, in fact, this is something that makes them happy.
Oh, very, very much so. I think our associates very much look forward to work, and they enjoy the consistency of it. We ask them a lot of times, what's your favorite part of the job? And what they say is that it's because we have created structure and instructions and order for them that allows them to be their best.
So what are we talking about? So employers will reach out to you and say, we need people to do these jobs, and families with autism will say, we need meaningful work for this person. You match them, huh?
Yeah, we do. We live at the intersection of there. So companies will outsource work to us. So whether that's financial operations or quality assurance or data management work. And then we convert that into processes and instructions, and then we do that work in our facility, typically in Downers Grove, and with a team of people with autism, like you say, people.
Does a company need to anticipate then that they're going to have autistic workers and that will require certain accommodations on their part? Do you integrate this staff? Do you prepare the staff that is there for the integration of somebody with autism? Can you talk briefly about that?
For the most part, our team of associates works at our facility. And that's designed intentionally that way because we wanted to be able to support a group of people that needed a broader range of support so that we're able, because all of our associates come to our facility, we're able to offer them supports more efficiently and effectively because they're all in one location.
So the work is outsourced to you there that way, correct?
Exactly. The work is outsourced. And then we have a single point of contact between our team and the client so that the client only has one person to deal with and doesn't have to learn about how to work directly with autism, at least not at first. And that's one of the things I think makes it easier for our customers is that they don't have to learn all about the work, about transferring the work, about outsourcing, and about autism at the same time. We're able to just turnkey and take the work, and then over time, we are able to educate our clients about autism, about the talents, and about the other skills of what people have.
And it sounds to me like I like the fact that there's built-in quality control, and maybe the employer feels good about engaging these people who do want to work well. So it sounds like a win for everybody. David Friedman is the founder and CEO of Autonomy Works. I want to make sure I get this website, David, as we hand it out here. Is it autonomy.works.com?
Yes. No, just autonomy.works. www.autonomy.works.
Oh, that's right, because .works is a URL or is a whatever you call it. It's like .com, .gov, .works. So autonomy.works. Got it. Okay. Yeah, David, really interesting. Thanks for your time. Good luck to you all.
Yeah, thank you, John. Enjoyed it.
Yeah, I did too. April is Autism Awareness Month. Autonomy.works. Pete, you said that's a tricky website for me. And you said it's autonomy.works. And I thought, no, it's not. Yes, it is. Autonomy.works. Brian Burroughs got the Business Minute.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is asking Deerfield-based Walgreens to space out first and second doses of the Pfizer COVID-19 vaccine 3 weeks apart instead of four. Walgreens has been scheduling doses of both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines 28 days apart, but the new CDC guidance is recommending 21 days for Pfizer. Walgreens has been criticized for canceling some second doses of vaccine, leaving patients scrambling to make second appointments within the proper window. North Shore University Health System and GoPath Laboratories are partnering to launch a new genetics test that assesses inherited risk of prostate cancer. The test factors in family history, rare pathogenic mutations, and genetic risk score. And the test only requires a simple saliva or blood test. Chicago-based travel booking website Orbitz is focusing a new ad campaign on the LGBTQIA+ community. The campaign, called Travel As You Are, is inviting all people to travel on their own terms, not the one society created for them. I'm Ryan Burrow. That's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Steve Alexander's got Agribiz.
Yeah, I hope you recovered from Deep Dish Pizza Day, John, because today we've got a twofer connection between the farm and your belly. It's National Caramel Popcorn Day, or caramel, if you prefer, and we are celebrating the dish that millions of pasta lovers identify as the taste of Italy. It is National Carbonara Day. The pork farmers of America would appreciate it if you included a little bacon in yours. Here's a statement that's going to get farmers and corn traders excited.
We could see $7 or $8 corn prices easily.
Oh, hold on, though. Some context is necessary. When an ag economist recently warned that we could run out of corn, I wondered what that would look like. Will there not be enough corn to feed livestock? Will there not be enough corn to make chips for us to dip? Well, neither, actually, because, as Scott Irwin, an ag economist and professor at the University of Illinois, explains, we won't run out of corn. There could just be less of it to go around.
to an economist, in some sense, there's really never a shortage. It's always a question of price.
And faced with China's huge purchases of U.S. corn, combined with a lower-than-usual amount of corn in the bins in the United States, and with last week's USDA's shocking prediction that farmers would plant a few million fewer acres of corn, and forecasters, some of them anyway, suggesting we could have a widespread drought this summer in the Corn Belt?
The real difficult scenario would emerge is if we did get that drought here in the heart of the Corn Belt next summer, then literally there would not be enough to go around, and the market's job would be to basically price some users out of the market so that we literally don't run out of corn.
Which would mean higher prices, possibly.
Like we saw in 2011, 2012. $7 or $8 corn prices easily.
Maybe pray for rain, because as farmers say, rain makes grain. Quiet right now at the Chicago Board of Trade, with beans up a nickel, corn is flat, and wheat is down about 2 cents. And that's your money on 720 WGN.
Wintrust Business Lunch. Let's visit with Amy Guth now and cover as much ground as we can. Let's start with United Airlines. Steve Alexander mentioned this earlier, and I had questions about it. Flight school, what's going on here, Amy?
Yeah, this is a very interesting story that caught my eye. So United, and of course, I watch them closely since they're based locally. What they're doing is they have made a pledge that they want to, they want 10,000 more pilots, but 5,000 of which they want to train themselves. And so they had previously bought a flight academy, and they what they're really focusing on right now is that they're trying to increase the diversity of pilots. Only about 20% of pilots for United right now are women and or people of color. And so they're trying to even that up and shore that number up and make it at least half. And so part of that is to get people into the pipeline to becoming pilots. Turns out is unbelievably expensive. Flight school is about $100,000. And then it takes about a year. And on top of that, it takes about another 5 years to get with a major airline. You have to be like a training instructor and then usually fly for a smaller regional plane or a carrier, something like that, and then move up to one of those larger carriers. So part of this program with United is that they will guarantee a job for you once you've gone through this program, once you have reached the required minimum of flight hours. You can't just come out of flight school. You have to be experienced and be in the air a lot. But they are helping to guarantee some jobs to get people in that pipeline. And part of this is coming from something that's very interesting because, you know, I know when I first saw this story, I thought, well, didn't they just get rid of a ton of pilots?
Right.
Well, part of the issue is there is a federal law saying that pilots must retire by age 65. You cannot keep going after that, however much you may want to. And so as pilots are aging out of their jobs, so, you know, there's kind of creating this pipeline issue. So they're trying to get more pilots in the pipeline to account for the number of pilots that are going to be retiring soon in the next couple of years. So we saw a very large number of pilots who took early retirement or who did a voluntary separation this past year when travel was so impacted by the pandemic. United is trying to hire some back really pretty much right away. They're going to get a few hundred new pilots that they're looking to hire. But this is an interesting strategy for making sure that they are getting, you know, pilots, getting the pilots that they want and answering to some of their diversity goals and making sure they're reaching them.
Did I see that they're offering some sort of scholarships? Because that could be a barrier, too.
Yeah, they are. So they have invested $1.2 million in scholarships. And then J.P. Morgan Chase, who backs the United Frequent Flyer credit card, they have contributed another $1.2 million towards scholarships. So that's, you know, $100,000 for flight school. That's pretty darn expensive. So that will certainly help, hopefully, encourage a lot of people. Applications open this week, and they're hoping to take at least 100 people this year.
Talk to me about what Starbucks is doing in South Korea.
Yeah, so Starbucks has really been talking quite a bit in the last couple of years about their sustainability goals and things they're going to do around that. They're piloting a program in Seattle that's kind of a borrow and return cup program to try to cut down on waste. But they have announced that for their South Korean market, they're trying to reduce their carbon footprint by 30% by 2025, which is really just right around the corner, really. And so they're going to introduce what they're calling a circular cup program. It's kind of an interesting idea to encourage people to reuse cups. basically you will pay a small deposit for a reusable cup, and then when you're finished, you can still take it to go, but then when you're finished, you can return it at a contactless return kiosk. So I'm sure they'll have some kind of identifier, so they'll know your cup came back, you get that deposit back. And so that's their solution, but they're trying to be completely disposable cup free by 2025 in South Korea. I'm sure we're going to start seeing this in other markets because Starbucks has made this such a big priority of talking about their sustainability and where they're going.
Well, I would imagine that would work in America too. I don't know how we
Certainly.
Compare to them about being conscientious or green, but I would imagine the Starbucks crowd would like to participate in something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this pilot happening in Seattle, that's just a 2-month pilot. And I'm sure once we learn about how that went and how Seattle reacted to it, we'll probably start to see that in other cities.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.